Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Alaska Airlines Club 49. Membership information available at club49hub.com. Thank you and welcome to Juno Afternoon from Community Supported KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. You can also join us via our live stream on KTOO's YouTube and Facebook pages. First Friday for February is coming up next week, and today we chat with the Juno Douglas City Museum and Dave Wetzel about his new exhibition titled Atmospheric Landscapes, a collection of oil paintings depicting local familiar landscapes. The annual Fireside Lectures from the U.S. Forest Service continue tomorrow night with Pete Griffin's presentation, Diary of a Forest Ranger. Pete is here to share about this special talk and his 37 years in the Forest Service. And today, we begin with Carl Brodersen, the mastermind behind WorldQuest 2026, an extravaganza of trivia happening this Saturday night, January 31st. It's the annual fundraiser for the Juno World Affairs Council. It's Saturday, January 31st at Centennial Hall. Doors open at 6 p.m. There's a buffet at 6:15. The show's at 6:45. And Carl says, well, it's done by 9:30, maybe 10, somewhere in that zone. It's the 20th annual World Quest. That's insane. Well, we welcome now to the studio Carl Brodersen. Carl, how are you today?
I'm still here. Production week is an exhausting time frame, so I'm quite sleepy and apologize in advance for my inarticulateness.
That's okay. I'm sure you're going to be all ready by Saturday night.
Oh, yeah.
This is an annual fundraiser for the Juno World Affairs Council. You all bring in people to talk about things that happen in the world, like you just had one yesterday. You also have Tuesday travelogues, and I think there's one coming up soon for that, yeah?
Yep, we have a travelogue in the middle of February, and then on Tuesday we have a regular speaker with her title is so long, but a former Assistant Secretary of Defense for African Affairs.
Yes. And that's this coming Tuesday?
Coming Tuesday,
okay,
yes.
Okay, great. And so there's all kinds of events that they put on, and those events are always free of charge, and one of the ways they pay for that is this WorldQuest 2026 Trivia Night, which has become very popular. Sometimes it's people's favorite event of the year. They look forward to it. And again, it's this Saturday night. You can go to jwac.org to find out more information about what the organization does and also information on securing yourself a spot, a ticket, or what have you for WorldQuest on Saturday night. So, Carl, I know production week is busy, as you said, but it's also you are the trivia mastermind. You come up with new questions every year. So how long do you spend crafting and researching and finding these questions?
All year. But, I mean, that would make a good question. I'll put that in the file, throughout the first 11 months. But then for the last month, it's just I got to sit down and hammer these out.
Ah, okay. Do you keep like a thing on your phone so you can, something comes up interesting, you mark it?
Essentially, I'm old school. I have a Word document on my computer on my desk. But yeah,
same
idea. Okay. You're always looking for trivia because at this point, I mean, we're well into the 700 plus questions that have been written for this thing over the years. And I know that I'm repeating myself. I just can't remember which ones are actually the repeats. But I must think that bit of trivia is really important if I've asked it two or three times over the decades.
And when you're looking for a trivia question, what is it that you think about? Like, is it the difficulty level? Is it the category it's in? How do you determine, oh, this is a good idea?
Because it's interesting. And that's the basis of all of the questions, is that is fun or interesting or weird or In some cases, horrifying. But we try to avoid horrifying. This is a fun event. But just this elicits a reaction. This is a very interesting piece of information. And then how can I make a puzzle out of it?
I see. Okay. Yeah. And do you spend a lot of time crafting questions specifically about Alaska or Southeast, or is it worldwide?
In fact, there are five rounds, and the first round every year is just Alaska questions.
Okay, great.
Yeah,
wow.
And then after that, there's year in review, and I'd like to say anymore that because we're here to recharge emotionally, we tend to avoid current events on the year in review questions. We're trying to keep this as positive and lighthearted as possible. And let me tell you, it has been harder and harder and harder every year to write positive, uplifting, non-soul-crushing trivia events or questions. But then the last three rounds are all just totally random. We actually try to avoid categories because if the category comes up, you know, Taylor Swift, some people will be thrilled and other people will be out for the next 10 questions.
Right.
You want everyone to have a shot at each question. And they're long. I mean, it's a PowerPoint slide. They're like almost like word questions from math class back in high school. But I say fun and entertaining. Not everyone's a math person.
The train left the station at 11:30.
Yes. But in saying that, there's some interesting detail about it left the station but not the platform. And that tells you who made it. And that's what the question that's. It's that kind of thing. So I at least want it so that people can, you know, discount one or two of the multiple choice options based on a detail that was hidden in the question. So even if you don't know, you can at least divine your way to a 50-50 guess.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's a good point. So in this trivia event, you're giving me a list of four or five possible answers?
Absolutely, yes.
Okay, so I'm not having to come cold from this.
No.
So if it is a current event, I can't remember, you know, which celebrity divorced which celebrity last year, you're going to give me some options and I might be able to discern
Definitely.
From those. But you might put a tricky one in there because it may be somebody from 2024 instead of 2025 or something like that.
Right, exactly.
I see.
Although
okay.
I try not to trick people. Usually if you think there's an obvious answer, that's probably it.
You're not, this is supposed to be a fun event,
yeah.
Right? It's not trying, you're not trying to like, you know, challenge somebody to the nth. You don't need IQs of 200 or whatever it
oh,
is.
Oh, heavens
to,
no.
to participate. Now, here's the thing. I just feel like I know there's an event tomorrow night as well for the Alaska Music Summit that's happening. There's a trivia event. I know Connor Lendrum is hosting that. He's also hosting a trivia, I think, weekly or something at the Devil's Club. And there's all these other. And I have known that trivia, bar trivia, has been a thing for, I don't know, a while. But it seems like there's something about trivia right now that's like growing. Do you feel that sense? Like there's something about it? I mean, you've been doing this for 20 years or whatever. Like, have you seen it grow over that time?
It certainly seems like it, yeah. I mean, you know, board games have become more popular than they're at the same time frame. I think people just like a good game and it's really interesting.
Yeah. So, I mean, it goes back to my grandfather kicking my butt during Trivial Pursuit, right?
Right.
How many pie pieces can you get, right? Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's been, so trivia has been around forever, but I just feel like this kind of interactive, get a team together, go have a social experience at an event or at a bar or at an event like this that's a fundraiser. It just seems like that's becoming a really great way to sort of participate in community and do something positive in the world.
Yeah, getting together and laughing, even that is in a way an act of resistance and is certainly a thing that feels good. And you think, you know, during the pandemic, there were a lot of Zoom trivia activities.
Sure.
Cause it's a thing, yeah, it's a thing you can do as a group without having to sit around the Trivial Pursuit board physically.
Right.
And I'll bet that helped to spur it on. And now that we can get back into a room together, then we can all sit around a table eating dinner at a buffet at a fundraiser while playing trivia on a big screen.
So how did you get, were you, did you miss a meeting and they're like, Carl will do all the questions?
Kind of. Many, many years ago, a friend's parents brought me in to be on their team at this event, and I was supposed to be the ringer. And I made the difference on literally one question, because the World Affairs Councils of America has a WorldQuest fundraiser question set that they provide. And no shade to them, but they were very specific and persnickety questions. My favorite example is, you know, what was the GDP of Micronesia in 1972?
Oh, my goodness.
They give you four options all within $10 million of each other. So not only do you maybe not care at all, there's no way to even divine your way to a good guess.
Right.
Yeah. And so with that's also in mind, I went up to the folks that ran the first WorldQuest I went to afterwards and said of the screen that had the Excel spreadsheet that had all of the scores on it for each team, you know, if you sorted that after each round, it'd be easier to see who's in the lead? And that's just the two-button click to make that happen. And they looked at me with twinkles in their eyes and said,
uh-oh,
you have shown interest, young man. And next year, wrote the entire event.
Right, of course. That's the way it always is.
And how.
And so do you now, are you looking to solicit help, or do you anticipate passing it on to some Padawan at some point here?
There should always be a succession plan. Would love to get partners involved in it. It's just, I think, a matter of finding the right person and seeing what happens. Or alternatively, my wonderful wife and I are expecting our first two children at once. We're having twins.
Oh, my goodness. Congratulations.
Thank you. In the next month or two. And so I will have two 10-month-olds during the next World Quest.
Oh, wow.
And so the joke, at least this year, is if there is one next year, it will all be diaper questions.
Right. That's so funny. And what's the good, or I guess, what is the trick to being a good quiz master?
You're there to help people to the right answer and to entertain them in the process, whether they get it or not.
Yeah.
You don't want to trick anybody. You want to give them a shot. You want to make sure that everybody can play and just make sure that the information is inherently interesting. So even if you don't get the question as a player, you still think, huh, that is really interesting to know. Or, oh, I see what he did there. That's clever.
Ah, I see. Okay, that's kind of fun. All right, so tell me how this event on Saturday is going to work. We're talking about World Quest 2026 with Carl Broderson from the Juno World Affairs Council here on Juno Afternoon. It's Saturday night, January 31st. What do I expect? How do I participate? What do I do?
Tickets are available online in advance if you want, or always at the door. We've never run out. You walk in. If your team captain, if you have one, has reserved a table space for you, go and find that, or just find one of the empty tables and start your own. Or a couple of them will say, please join us. There's a sign in the middle. And so if you're there by yourself with one or two other people, that's how the teams can naturally coalesce, because otherwise approaching a table that's half full and saying, can I join you, is a horrifying idea, and we try to avoid people having to do that. Dinner starts almost immediately. You run through the buffet. There's a no-host bar over in the corner, and then, you know, after about half an hour of that, we start the game, and it's just a PowerPoint. And so it's like watching a really large, long, well-thought-out presentation. And it's hosted or presented by Jesse Keel and Christina Apathy, who do a wonderful job tag teaming really complicated questions with a lot of pronunciation issues that they have not seen until that evening.
Oh, really? You don't give them the things in advance?
Because I don't have them done in advance.
I see.
I usually print the script at 2 a.m. the night
before. Oh, my goodness. Yeah. And how many questions do you create?
There are 50 points to be had. There are lightning round questions near the end, which are only worth a quarter of a point.
Okay.
And so it's technically more, but those are important because you can't have an entire question that just says, what country is this, or what is the capital of X? But that's important information, and I like to reward the people who study ahead of time and know that.
Yeah.
And so then you could have eight questions in a row that are, what country is this, and this, and this, and this, and they just fly by.
That's so fun.
And one year we did outlines of countries that were flipped upside down and then reversed.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So, you know, after this many decades, you got to put a spin on it occasionally.
Geography is my worst category. I would not be helpful at all. Okay, and so tickets are $75 or $40 for students. You can get those, like Carl said, at the JWAC website, jwac.org. And what are we wearing? What kind of event? What should I feel like?
We always encourage people to, you know, make an event out of it if they want. You know, dress really formally or put on something international to make it entertaining. We have people in full evening gowns. I wore a kilt one year. Mm. But by the same token, if you just want to go and relax, then fleece pants.
Right,
yeah,
okay.
It's a broad spectrum event. We want everybody to just feel good. But if there aren't a ton of opportunities to dress up in this town, and so if you want some place that you can wear your shoe fly boots and a fur stole, wear that, by golly.
Now, you mentioned that you like to reward sometimes the people who maybe have prepared in advance. So if I'm thinking about going to this thing on Saturday, how can I prepare? Obviously, I should study the current events from last year.
Mm-hmm.
Right? More pop culturally events, or
one or two of those occasionally, but it's just so wild and varied. There's always flag questions. I mean, that's pretty consistent.
Mm.
Capitals or what country is this? That kind of a thing. Like, just look over a political boundaries map before you come in. But one thing I notice that a lot of the questions anymore, as I struggle for new material, just reflect my own hobbies and interests.
Mm.
So unfortunately, there's a lot of boats and Europe and World War II.
And twins.
That coming up. Yes. Yes. We have things related to difficult pregnancies leading into that. And extremely strong, resilient women. But
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's a real mix.
That's awesome. Well, it's the Juno World Affairs Council, a wonderful event to help fundraise for all of the things they do in town, all the forums, the travel logs, the speaker series, everything that they do over there at the Juno World Affairs Council. You can support that by going to WorldQuest and having a little bit of fun. That's kind of awesome.
And a lot of that money goes directly to K2 for filming our presentation. So you got a double whammy.
Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. Well, it's full disclaimer, I guess. We have to put that in there. Thank you, Carl, so much for coming in. It's really a pleasure to have you here today.
Thank you for having me.
Gwyneth Cheesh. This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO. We're going to listen to this week's Our Living Lands from Native Voice One.
This is Our Living Lands, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Jeanette Didios is Jicarilla Apache and Diné and reports for KUNM Radio in Albuquerque. Our Living Lands producer, Daniel Spalding, spoke to Didios about issues facing indigenous communities in New Mexico.
You've been reporting on the New Mexico State Legislature session. What are some of the issues you're seeing there that are most relevant to indigenous communities?
Yeah, sure, of course. Our legislature here in New Mexico just started on Tuesday. And I think just jumping in, there has been a lot of, you know, reactions from New Mexicans about, you know, rallies and protests. And there was a protest on Tuesday. And I think the biggest thing was just everyone speaking their voice. I mean, it wasn't just one central issue, but when I went to talk to folks, especially indigenous folks on that day, a lot of people were concerned about land rights, water rights, as well as ICE, you know, that Minneapolis issue that happened. It's been seen and heard across the country. And even in New Mexico, there's folks that are worried and concerned of whether Native Americans are safe. You know, it's kind of ridiculous to think that, you know, there would be an issue with us, but there is. You know, Native Americans are being prosecuted, they're being detained, they're being deported, and, you know, a lot of Native Americans don't feel safe. You know, even if they have the proper identifications, birth certificates, ICE are turning around and saying that it's not real and that it's not official. So what more can we do, you know?
New Mexico is home to many different tribal nations and people, as well as, you know, a varied landscape and weather. How do you approach covering such diversity and environment and people?
I think when it comes to environment and people, it's really first off just to research as much as you can so that you understand the landscape of where people are in both sides of the table. I mean, a lot of what we're covering right now is in regards to Chaco Canyon, and there's both sides to whether or not they should decrease the borderline for oil and gas or widen it to protect the cultural landscape of it. And it's interesting because there's Native American folks on both sides of the table, some that want to continue oil and gassing because it's their land and it's their right to do whatever they want. And on the other side, there's other Native Americans that want to protect the cultural aspect of it. And, you know, it's kind of hard to, you know, say who's right and who's wrong. And to be able to cover and report on that, I think it's important to understand where they're both coming from and make sure that you accurately report on it and get both sides of the table so that those that are listening, your readers and folks get understand the full scale of it.
And you're from New Mexico. Can you share why you wanted to become a journalist and report on these topics in your home state?
And I think I wouldn't continue being a journalist if I couldn't cover indigenous issues, because that's really the heart of it for me. Like, seeing the impact that I can do to help other indigenous folks really shine a light on some of the issues that's been going on, I think that's what really does it for me. Like, it really, you know, it continues my fuel to continue reporting. I mean, for example, I think about 2 years ago, the Mescalero Apaches, they had a fire around their reservation. And I drove down there to report on it, even though it's about 2-3 hours from Albuquerque. And I was a little uncertain about going down there because, you know, they're just, you know, are recovering from fires. You know, some people may not want to talk to me. I totally understood that. And there wasn't a lot of reporting in the local news. So I was one of the only people that was specifically covering the Mescalero Apaches. And when I went down there, you know, they were so generous with their time and willing to talk to me and tell me what's been happening. And, you know, I really took that as a really kinship moment, because they were willing to help me, ask me if I needed anything, water and food, when in reality, you know, I wanted to be that for them. You know, so we were both trying to help each other. And I really thought that was a really special moment.
And my final question, last but not least, but I have to ask this one. Are you a red or green chili? Which color, which chili are you?
I would like to say Christmas because that would be a great answer. But I am a little biased and I love green chili more than red. I love my green chili chicken enchiladas. That's what I like.
Tune in next week for more stories about how climate change affects tribal communities. I'm Antonia Gonzalez for Our Living Lands, a collaboration of Kuwanic Broadcast Corporation, Native Public Media, and the Mountain West News Bureau.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Hanson Gress, Ka eat with the Shu Yi, we Kashuk are ye tin. Jin Katka K Jin Tauk Anakaya Haanikuk Gunish Cheesh.
You are listening to Community Supported Juneau Afternoon on KTOO at 104.3 Juneau, 91.7 Juneau Auk Bay, and online at kto.org. I'm Boston Christopher. You can also join us on our live stream on KTO's YouTube and Facebook pages. The next First Friday is February 6th, and the City Museum has a new exhibition going up, Dave Wetzel's Atmospheric Landscapes. It will have an opening reception on Friday, February 6th from 4:30 to 7 p.m. Plus, there's all kinds of other stuff going on at the museum. And of course, I have the fantastic Kate Ross joining me in studio. Wasiati, how are you, Kate?
Hi, Boston. Doing good.
Excellent. And then from California right now, but he'll be here soon because he has to install the show, I think we have Dave Wetzel. Can you hear me, Dave? Dave, can you hear me?
Yeah, it just froze. Now I can hear you.
Okay, great. Good. Nice. Always strange when the connection is remote. We got to make sure we can hear you okay. So that's good. So we'll start with you, Kate, and before we get to talking to Dave here about atmospheric landscapes, but what's happening at the City Museum there? Did you all suffer from Snowmageddon and have to push things or what?
We sure did. we have up right now, we have Susan Watson, an exhibit called Meeting Awareness. And tomorrow and Saturday are the last 2 days that you can come and see that show before we get Dave Wetzel's show up next week. So her opening got pushed back actually a couple times, but it's a fantastic show. So I highly recommend people try and make it in tomorrow or Saturday. So Friday or Saturday from 10 to 4. It's a fantastic exhibit. And then we also have a continuing exhibit on Beaver Pond, which is a photography exhibit by Damon Stubner. And it's all about the beavers that live out by Outer Point.
Oh, fun.
Yeah, it's a very fun photography exhibit, and it has a lot of information about the beavers. There's trivia. So that's a really, really cool, especially if you like walking out there, you know, if that's a little hike that you enjoy, it's a really, really cool exhibit.
Yeah, Damon works over at the Alaska State Museum as an archivist, I believe, but he's a wonderful photographer. Mm-hmm. You can find his work on Instagram. Mm-hmm. And so having a cool exhibit. And that's going to run through February?
That will continue running through February. Yep.
Okay. So that's one of those multi-month exhibits. Uh-huh. All right. Cool. And you're still on winter hours and all that?
We're still on winter hours, Tuesday through Saturday, 10 to 4. Free admission. February is thanks to Mary Pat Wyatt and Paul Volkers and the Pioneers of Alaska. Igloo number 6. So we're really grateful to all of our community sponsors keeping it free admission all through the winter.
I love that. Mm-hmm. That's really cool. And then you have this Atmospheric Landscapes from Dave Wetzel. Dave, how are you?
Great. How are you doing?
I'm excellent. So tell me a little bit about this show that you have coming up. I'm also going to hopefully be able to, for those who are on the stream, I'm going to look at Dave's website here because it has a couple of examples of landscapes. Is that similar to what we're going to see in this show coming up next week?
Yeah.
Oh, he froze a little bit. Maybe we're having some connection difficulties with the old interwebs.
Yeah. That's, can you hear me now?
Yeah, I can hear you now. So, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so it's going to be similar to a lot of the work that I've done before. Really, like to concentrate on scenes from around Juneau that people recognize. You know, that I'll have a picture in there of the lights in downtown Juneau. There's a view from the top of the tram. There's a painting of the Peterson Lake Saltchuk. And, you know, really, really enjoy when people can see something and they recognize it. I had somebody comment today on one of my paintings that's going to be in the show. It's of the Brotherhood Bridge with the fireweed in bloom. And his comment was, he lives out of town now. And he just said, "Oh man, I really missed that view." And
oh yeah,
that meant a lot to me because it not only did somebody recognize it, but it gave them a feeling of being there and being back in Juneau. So anyway, I really like to focus on a lot of local scenes. But the something I've really been working on a lot lately is creating atmosphere in paintings. I took a class over this last summer with an artist named Dave Santillanes. And that's really the focus of a lot of his work, and is to create a lot of depth in your paintings. So I really tried to work on some of those concepts for the paintings for this show.
Interesting. Okay, that's kind of fun. I mean, I'm looking at your website here, and there's one photo. It looks like it's from Sandy Beach area. And it has some depth in there. Like, you've got the trees in the foreground, and then you see, like, the containers and the tankers and from across the pond there, from across the channel. And then the mountain in the background, and I see a little airplane there too in the sky, and so that's really, really fun. I love this old pump house, of course, with the sun. These are, and so you're getting inspiration from all the landscapes in and around Juneau. Is that right?
Yeah. There'll be some paintings from other places that I've either visited or, you know, things that really appeal to me. But I really like painting a lot of the Juneau scenery. It's, well, as you know, I mean, it's sort of unlimited for subjects around there. So
fantastic. Yeah. And you've been here since 1991. Is that right?
That's right.
Yeah. So you're no stranger to the landscapes. And do you look at different times of year, too? Do you find like you have a certain time of year that you love sort of looking at the landscapes?
You know, I've done a lot of different seasons there, so I wouldn't say there's one in particular I focused on, but I think I was really into darker scenes for this show coming up. There are a lot of scenes that are at night or very dark, so you know, really kind of trended that way this time.
I see. Okay. And Kate, is Dave's show part of the thing that people apply for to have a show at the City Museum, or how does that work?
Yeah, so every year we have applications open for solo artist shows at the museum, and there's a couple different opportunities. The larger gallery space is where Dave Wetzel's exhibit will be, and those are the ones that are up for 1 month in the winter, the solo artist shows. And then we have our community gallery space where we have the Beaver photography exhibit right now, and it's a little bit smaller space, but those are up for 2 months. And so applications are in the summer. I think they open in August or something like that.
I see.
And they're always for the next year.
The next year.
Yeah, so you have lots of time to plan. It's always fun to come in and see how different artists use the space. We try to get a lot of different mediums, a lot of different types of art represented.
Yeah, so you, Dave, you applied for this then in 2024, basically.
That's right.
Yeah, okay. That's right. And what made you want to apply and have a solo show at the City Museum?
Well, I was encouraged by some of the staff there at the museum to apply, and my last show was 2 years ago at the Jack, and I really like to take these opportunities because it keeps me focused, it keeps me painting at a regular rate, and it gives me a goal to look forward to. So, you know, I really was looking forward to, excuse me, to applying to the City Museum because I think it's a really nice space, and yeah, I'm just really excited to get in there.
So how do you do your work? Do you take photos of the landscapes and then paint it at home? Are you out there in the wild painting, or do you, what is your process for that?
You know, I'd say it's a little bit of each because sometimes it makes sense to go out and do a little sketch in the field just to kind of get your proportions and the colors right and things like that. And maybe I'll take a photograph just for the colors for reference, and then I can bring that back to the studio. Sometimes the painting that I start in the field is good enough to just develop that into a studio painting, but most of the time it just ends up being a study sketch where I'll transfer it over to something bigger.
I see. Okay. And what brought you to, I'm always fascinated by how people get to the specific kind of art that they do? Like, what brought you to landscapes? Where did that begin for you?
Well, you know, my dad was a professional artist growing up, but he mainly did wildlife, particularly birds, and mostly watercolors. So as a little kid, I started doing that kind of thing. But then as I got into high school, I just enjoyed using oils a lot more. They're a little more forgiving. I mean, if you're applying oil paint and you really don't like it, you can just take a paper towel and wipe it off and start over again. So, that's not really possible. With watercolor, you have to be really precise and planned out. And when something's down, it's down. But oil takes a long time to dry. It's really easy to fix mistakes or to add something else on later. So nice. I really appreciate it. Yeah.
That's really cool. And so I love the idea that you are also like using a show because it does give you that sense of like a deadline. Do you find yourself working? When do you mostly work? Do you work in the early morning? Do you work at night? And do you try to keep up like a daily rhythm as an artist, or how does that work for you?
I would love to be that disciplined, but it usually comes more in spurts, you know, like I'll have an idea for painting. And then once the hard part is really getting that idea down on to start on the canvas and plan out the composition and things like that. But once it's actually started, things go pretty quickly. And I tend to like to work at night a little bit better for some reason.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's awesome. And you grew up in Florida, but now you're all the way across. You're diagonally all the way up here. And when did you start with painting or learning about art? Was it when you were younger back in Florida?
Yeah, it was when I was younger. I dug through my parents' stuff recently and found a little watercolor I did when I was 5. And you know, I just kind of worked on that and went through high school. And then I just did it sporadically for a while after that. And, you know, just, you know, had with a busy life. And then COVID came along and had all this time on my hands. And I thought, well, you know, this might be a good time to get this back going again. And it really worked out for me.
Reignite the passion, as it were. You know?
Yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, I love it.
Well, the work is lovely. You can I was looking at Dave's website. You can go to Dave Wetzel, WETZEL.com, DaveWetzel.com. Find out a little bit more about Dave, see some of his work. But what you really want to do is show up next Friday for the opening at the City Museum. That's going to be Friday, February 6th from 4:30 to 7 p.m. It's a collection of Dave's oil paintings depicting local familiar landscapes. And of course, everything we're talking about today with the museum, you can also find online at juno.org/museum. Kate, is there anything else that is coming up at the museum that we want to talk about?
Yeah, a couple other things in February. So first off is we have Elizabeth Peratrovich Day happening in February. And every year we do a little bit of events around that. So this year from February 17th to the 21st, we'll be celebrating Elizabeth Peratrovich Day. The film For the Rights of All, Ending Jim Crow in Alaska, will be available on demand to view. We'll have an Elizabeth Peratrovich scavenger hunt with maybe prizes at the end.
All right, prizes are good.
And then another really cool thing about that is that we have some local classrooms that do art projects around Elizabeth Peratrovich and her legacy of civil rights. And so we have these classroom projects on display at the museum. In past years, it's been a combination of paintings and art that students have created on a slideshow or big physical pieces of art with, you know, classrooms each contributing small little pieces to it. So there's a lot of different ways that the classrooms get creative with that. And so that will be on display during that week as well. We also have free copies of the book In Sisterhood, The History of Camp 2 of ANS. So if you've never read that book before, swing by and pick up a free copy. So yeah, always love celebrating Elizabeth Peratrovich Day and her history of championing and helping legislate civil rights in Alaska. Yep. The other thing we have in February is our deadline for registration for 12 by 12.
Okay.
So as people have heard us talk about, we have the annual 12 by 12 community art exhibition that opens in March. And it's open to anyone in the community that wants to submit a piece of art. The theme this year is monochrome in color. So we want pieces that are monochromatic. And that can be 12 by 12 by 12 if you want to be 3D. All the information is on our website. You can bring an entry form in physically, or you can just email us. And those applications are due February 14th.
Okay, awesome. Juno.org/museum is where you can find out everything going on at the Juno Douglas City Museum. Kate Ross, thank you so much. And Dave Wetzel joining us, who will be returning to Juno here shortly to get his show installed. And thank you for joining us, Dave, and telling us a little bit about your show coming up, Atmospheric Landscapes. Going to Cheech for being here today.
Yeah, thank you very much. Enjoyed it.
Awesome. And thank you, Kate. Gwyneth Cheech.
Gwyneth Cheech.
This is Juno Afternoon on KTOO.
You're listening to KTOO's Thingit Word of the Week. This week's word comes from Keishi Bessie Cooley. The word this week is yun.
Yun.
That means hemlock. And here's a sentence.
Yun at kahi li nukt ka nauk yis tu yedu uch.
Hemlock sap is sweet. And it is collected for medicine, too. Let's hear it again.
Yen.
Hemlock. Gwyneth Cheech to Chune Lance Twitchell, Gold Belt Heritage Foundation, and the University of Alaska Southeast for this audio.
Keishi Bessie Cooley is Kokhetan and a child of a Yen Yedi man. She is from Daisleen, Teslin, and grew up spending time in Teslin and around Teslin Lake. She earned a master's degree in Indigenous Languages and Linguistics and interviewed many speakers for the Hashagun language series. She is currently translating projects for the Children of the Taku Society.
And tune in next week for another Tlingit Word of the Week from KTOO.
Support for Juno Afternoon comes from Heritage Coffee Roasting Company, providing Juno with locally roasted coffee for over 40 years, with cafes and drive-through locations throughout Juno. More at heritagecoffee.com. You're listening to Juno Afternoon from Studio 2K at KTOO. I'm your host, Boston Christopher. That is a little bit of Vox Borealis, who is inviting you to an intimate evening of choral music out at the Shrine of St. Therese. It's called Midwinter Evensong. It's offering a reflective journey through light, silence, and hope inspired by the ancient tradition of evening prayer. There's going to be all kinds of work that they're going to be doing. They're just beautiful, lovely voices to listen to. You can do that Saturday, January 31st at 7 p.m. or Sunday, February 1st at 2 p.m. That is, again, out at the Shrine of St. Therese. And, of course, admission is pay as you can at the door. And you can find Vox Borealis on Facebook and Instagram, I believe, as well. That's a little Vox Borealis here on Juno Afternoon. And tomorrow night, the Fireside Lecture Series from the Forest Service continues at 7 p.m. Friday, January 30th, with Pete Griffin's Diary of a Forest Ranger. Pete spent 37 years with the U.S. Forest Service, with his last 11 years in Juneau. He retired from the Forest Service in June of 2010. Pete now writes books, shares stories live, and also serves as an Alaska naturalist on some of the cruise ships. And you can find his work at thestorytellingranger.com. But better yet, Pete joins us now in studio. Gunnath Cheesh, welcome in. Wasiyitzi, how are you?
Thank you, Boston. Gosh, it's great to be back here. I haven't been on a Juneau afternoon in, 7 or 8 years.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. Predates me, definitely. So you were back on the show way back in the day.
Way back.
So, you know, you retired in 2010, mm-hmm. But you've been with the Forest Service since 1973. So how did you, were you a young boy and you were into the wanting to get outside? How did you get into the Forest Service way back when?
Gosh, I spent a lot of my younger days in the woods, around home in Upper Michigan, running around the lake shores and on the trails and into the woods. And I realized growing up what I really wanted was a job in the woods where I never had to talk to another person all day long. I'm very introverted and and look at me now.
Now you're a storyteller in front of crowds.
Yeah, so I thought a job as a wildlife biologist with the Forest Service would be great. I could be out in the woods all day long and learn things about the outdoors.
And when you started in 1973, what were you doing?
I was a seasonal hire with the Forest Service, taking water samples at swimming beaches, conducting fisheries surveys in lower Michigan, and it was great. And I stuck with it. Several years as a seasonal employee, and when a permanent job opened up, I applied for it and was hired, and wow, it's been it was a wonderful career for me.
Wow, I'm always, you know, I've had a couple different journeys along the way, but I'm always amazed at people who, I know you moved around locations, obviously, mm-hmm. and you moved up here to Juneau, but, you know, that you stick with the same gig for so long, you know, the same organization and the same service and different roles, obviously, mm-hmm. but that's pretty amazing. That's admirable.
It certainly, well, it was at the time. I was raised to believe you get a job, you hang on to it for as long as you can. That was because you never could tell. You know, the economies were up and down, and having a job was an important thing. Whereas today, like my son went to work for Google down in Mountain View, California, and he worked for, gosh, a dozen companies in the years after he graduated, just going from one to another. And
oh, wow.
To me, that's odd, but that's the way the world is today.
Yeah, it's a little more bouncing around and stuff, I guess. Mm-hmm. I mean, there still are some places you can lock in and be in a place like that, but then you're also at the whim of, you know, so many other factors.
True.
And so you then came here to Juneau in like about 1999?
1999.
And what was your job when you were coming to Juneau?
I was hired to be the district ranger in Juneau, which on the Juneau Ranger District, which is about 3.5 million acres. It's the largest ranger district in the nation at 3.5 million acres. And the district ranger is kind of the administrative head of everything that goes on that ranger district. So I learned a lot about recreation and permitting and ice fields and helicopters and hard rock mining and timber sales and road building. It was what I found is life is a constant learning experience.
Mm-hmm. And how did you had you been to Alaska before?
I never had. Alaska was just one of those dreams I had growing up in Upper Michigan. Gosh, I wanted to, you know, I read all the outdoor magazines about hunting and fishing in Alaska, and I thought someday I want to get there. But when I got here, it was a move. It was a rung on a career ladder. I wanted to be the guy in charge.
Mm-hmm.
After I got to Alaska, and after a while, I'd applied for other promotions down south. They didn't come through. And after a while, I realized, gosh, why would I ever want to leave this place? Mm-hmm. It's just wonderful. There's so much wild lands. Fishing is wonderful. Lots of wonderful experiences. And this is home now.
Yeah, so you've retained your residency here since you retired.
Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Isn't it interesting that, like, you know, you do, and you were talking about, you know, you applied to some other positions down south, and then this happened to me too. Like, you get to a point in your life where you're like, it's not so much what I'm doing, but it's where I'm doing it.
This is true.
And you realize, okay, if I can be where I want to be and then do the thing that I want to mm-hmm. do as well, like, that's really good. But then there's always these people, you got all your career, your trajectory has to go mm-hmm. up. You got to mm-hmm. keep going up into management and all this stuff. Do you, though? Like, that's an interesting thought, right? Like, where are you happiest, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And you've retained it here and you've been here and now I want to talk about a little bit about this transition you made. So you retired
mm-hmm.
and you started, what happened when you retired? Did you start, had you already written any books or did that come after you retired?
That came after I retired.
Okay,
when
so how
I
did
retired,
this start for you?
I realized that retirement wasn't the end of work and sitting on the couch and not having to go to work on Mondays.
Right.
Retirement was the start of something new.
Mm.
And something had to take the place of work.
Mm-hmm.
But I came to the realization that I could fish and I could hunt all I wanted, but you can only eat so many fish and you can only eat so many moose.
Right.
Something else had to take my interest in, and take my time. And I realized that I'd just gotten into storytelling a little bit. Mm-hmm. I'd been on actually KTOO. I had to start telling natural history stories on the radio here at KTOO.
Okay.
A weekly series, Tongass Trails. People still ask me about that.
Wow. You want to do it again? Come on back.
I ran out of all the good ideas. I did it for 5 years.
Okay.
That translated into being invited by Disney to work as a naturalist on their cruise ships when I started in 2011, the year after I retired.
Okay.
So I had taken a lot of different classes, attended a lot of storytelling conferences, learning how to tell stories, and that gradually improved over the years. And then I had photographs to back it up. So I did a few cruises for Disney early in the career. And then when Princess found out what I was doing, they asked me if I'd be interested in working with them.
Mm.
And so I've been with Princess for just over 10 years now.
Wow.
Still do a couple of Disney trips a year. But it's been a really interesting detour.
Do you go on the cruise itself?
Yes.
Okay.
And Disney favors naturalists right here in Juneau, so folks will get on in Juneau, in mid-cruise, they'll cruise down to Vancouver. They'll pick up more passengers and will stay on the ship back to Juneau, get off, and another naturalist will get on.
I see. Okay.
With Princess flies me to where the cruise begins, so I'm on for the whole cruise.
Oh, that's so
fantastic. And I'll work with Princess for, 10, 11 weeks a season.
Yeah. Oh, that's amazing. So let's go back to the storytelling, because mm-hmm. you talked about how you started to get into that, basically because of the was it started by doing Tongass Trails here on KTOO? Or did you start to get into it before that?
I started to get an interest in stories before because I realized that the leadership in the U.S. Forest Service didn't tell stories.
Uh-huh.
And stories are how we pass along values and cultures of an organization or families. Stories are very important
mm-hmm.
for that. There's a book by Lisa Cron, Wired for Story, and she said the pleasure we derive from a well-told story is nature's way of telling us to pay attention to that story.
Mm.
And stories have been with us for millions of years. I think language was developed millions of years ago, according to the anthropologists. The written word has existed for only about 5,000 years.
Mm.
And so Lisa Cron said that our ability to grasp something with the opposable thumb was important, but it was stories that told us what it was important to hang on to.
Mm.
And so I realize that stories are a way of teaching, and so I tell a lot of stories on the ships, and folks, they just love stories. They love hearing stories.
Oh, absolutely.
Especially about bears and whales
yeah.
and personal experiences out in the woods.
Yeah. I mean, this is a little, not, you know, derivative or whatever, but I mean, as a boy, you know, Grizzly Adams, like mm-hmm. living in the mountains and having all those experiences. When I was like, you know, 7 years old, I'm watching this show and it's just like this, you know, this, it's nostalgic, right? It has this sort of allure to it. Mm-hmm. And I think because a lot of us don't do that. A mm-hmm. lot of us don't go out into the woods or survive or run into bears or have to deal with the things that you you dealt with as a ranger. And so that's just, that's fascinating, though, because I would imagine that people just eat it up, like the stories that you're telling.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there's always something to those stories that people learn from. And I like to tell stories of failure, my failure in particular. Stories where you're the hero of the story, they don't go over really well. But stories where
then
I
you're
go,
just talking about yourself.
That's right. But stories that where, gosh, I screwed up, and here's what I learned from that.
Yeah,
those
yeah.
are stories that people can identify with, and they'll remember.
When you were going to these storytelling workshops and learning the craft of storytelling, what were your – can you share some of your big takeaways of what you learned about storytelling?
The folks in the audience are pulling for you.
Uh-huh.
They're generally not there to go up to point and snicker if you screw up. And what I've found is that in telling a story, if I miss a point – mm-hmm. it's not a big deal. I can often circle back around to it, say, well, yeah, but you might not know that when I started this, I was doing something else, and here's what happened.
Mm-hmm.
But over the years, the stories get easier and easier to tell. I don't work from a script,
right.
But I've told these stories so many times, they come very easily now.
Do you ever surprise yourself when you're telling a story these days?
Once in a while.
Yeah.
I'll sometimes interrupt myself
if
a thought suddenly occurs that might add to that story.
Yeah.
And I'll often gauge the audience's reaction. If they react to that, I might keep that in a story in its retelling.
You're listening to Juno Afternoon. I'm talking with Pete Griffin, who is doing a fireside lecture, the series from the Forest Service that's happening for the next couple weeks, I believe. Still, you can go see these on Friday nights. They are happening at a different location than the Mendenhall Glacier Valley. We want to make sure to get that information out there. These are happening at the Forest Service on Back Loop Road, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so the you got to go to the office, the Forest Ranger office. Is that what it is?
Yes, and I believe the entrance will be open at the rear of the ranger station, rather than the public entrance.
I see. Okay, so you got to find your way to it a little bit.
Yes.
But that's awesome. So what this Diary of a Forest Ranger? What are you going to be doing tomorrow night? What are you going to be telling us?
Well, I'm going to be telling some stories from early in my career. You know, when I graduated from school, from college, I thought, well, I know everything I need to know to make my way in the world and change the Forest Service, because the Forest Service needed changing. But when I started out, I was questioned by an older gentleman once. He said, do you have any classes in forestry? I said, well, no, the school didn't offer any, but I really don't need any because I know everything I need to know to manage the forest.
Oh, that young hubris,
oh,
right?
Oh, gosh, yes. And so he quizzed me, and I gave him a couple of correct answers regarding forestry. Then he asked me a follow-up question, and I'm not sure about that. But here's what I know about that. And I told him what I knew, and he shook his head. He said, no. Mm-hmm. He said, that's actually the complete opposite of how we do things.
Oh, my goodness.
So, and that's one of my first stories.
Okay, yeah.
So there are a lot of that. Stories, there are some happy times, and there are some very sad times. In the sad times, I probably learned more about myself and life than the happy stories.
Right.
But those will all be there tomorrow night.
Yeah, tomorrow night. And then when you start thinking about these books that you do, the authoring the books, you're translating these stories into a book form?
Actually, I started telling the stories first at these storytelling conferences.
Okay.
And a publisher there said, gee, Pete, he said, I'd really like to get a book from you. And I said, well, you know, it takes a lot to write a book, but I had just crafted a one-person stage show that was done right here at 360 North Studios and broadcast live about those stories from my Forest Service career. And I'd written all those stories out. Well, shoot, there's 12,000 words right now. That's the start of a book.
Mm-hmm.
So I completed that during the pandemic. And during the pandemic, I had a chance to write another book about growing up on the Great Lakes, And just this past year, I completed yet another book. On my cruises, I keep a daily journal about the people I meet and the stories that I hear back from them. They say, oh, your story reminded me of growing up as a kid when this thing happened.
Oh, that's fun.
And I wrote those down. You know, over the 10, 15 years that I've been doing the cruise ships, I had enough stories to put together yet another book.
Oh, wow. And is that one already out?
That one will be out later this winter.
Okay. And what's that called?
Diary of a Cruise Ship Naturalist. How 30 years in the woods prepared me for overnight success on the ships.
Oh, that's so great. That's really great. So for you, Pete, I know you've had a lot of stories in here, and I'm just curious, is there like, can you share maybe like one of the weirder ones that you have? Like, is there something that like was a little off, that was a little strange to you? Like anything other, you know, I don't want to say otherworldly, but was there anything that was a little off?
Oh, gosh, yes. When I came to Juneau, we had a problem with beavers out in the Dredge Lakes area. The beavers were very happy and building dams and plugging culverts, and roads were washing out and trails were being flooded, got all kinds of complaints. And I thought, well, I'm a wildlife biologist. I know how to handle beavers. And so we put together a management plan where we were going to take care of the problem. We were going to eliminate some beavers in troubled areas. Mm. And we proposed that to the public, and oh my goodness, there was an outcry.
Mm.
That was not a good thing to do. We wanted to get a permit from the state in order to do the lethal trapping.
Mm.
And the governor at the time, Governor Murkowski, was not a fan of the Forest Service. And he said, well, this is not going to happen. Forest Service is not going to treat these families of beavers like they've treated the families of loggers in southeast Alaska. And oh, my goodness. We wrestled with that for a while. And eventually, I called together several of the people that were the most vociferous in opposition to my plan. And we got them together, and I said, well, you know, if you folks can come up with a plan that'll keep the trails dry, keep the culverts unplugged, and allow fish to reach spawning areas at no cost to the Forest Service, I'd be happy to consider that. And that group of folks said, well, can you give us a week to work on that? And I said, well, sure. They came back in a week, and they proposed a volunteer effort to keep the dams down and keep the culverts unplugged and the waters free-flowing in these difficult areas. And last year, I was out in the Dredge Lakes trails, and I ran into the Beaver Patrol. They're still working volunteer effort to keep the trails dry and the culverts unplugged.
That's amazing.
That was... That's one of the stories of failure that I do tell. That's actually a success story.
Yeah, that's really nice. That's great. If you want to hear more stories, Pete Griffin, Diary of a Forest Ranger, will be happening tomorrow night, the Fireside Lecture. It's out at the Forest Service district office,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
And you have to go in the back entrance. You can find out more information by Googling Fireside Lecture Series Forest Service, and it will come up. You can find it on Facebook, too, I believe. And it's fantastic to talk to you, Pete. And if you want more on Pete, you can go to storytellingranger.com. Look for his new book coming out later this winter.
Yes.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for joining us, Pete.
Oh, it's
really
been
appreciate
great.
You being here.
Oh, thanks for the invitation.
Appreciate it. Sheesh.
Sheesh.
That will do it for today's Juneau Afternoon. On tomorrow's show, live music with The Heists and Taylor Dallas Vidic, plus a chat with Juneau Ghostlight Theater about their latest radio play. Juneau Afternoon airs Wednesday through Friday at 3 p.m. right here on KTO Juneau 104.3 and KAUK Juneau Auk Bay 91.7. Hello, out the road. Find the show online at kto.org/JuneauAfternoon. You can also find live stream archives on KTOO's YouTube page. Our theme music is by Indian Agent. Programming support for Juno Afternoon comes from listeners and viewers like you and Alaska Airlines, Club 49, Hanson Gress, and Heritage Coffee Roasting Company. I'm Boston Christopher, producer and host of the program, with help today from Aaron Tripp. Gunath Cheesh, have a fantastic Juno evening.